This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for this program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. Molly Delaney is in the studio with me this morning, and I'm happy to have her to talk about supporting public radio. And we're also extra specially happy to have in the studio with us this morning Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And off and on over the years, she's been here quite a number of times to talk about that and answer insect questions. And usually about this time of the year, we ask her to come so she can talk about the internationally famous Insect Fear Film Festival going on now on the campus. Is this the 29th?
29 years
on the campus. 29 years bringing bad films about big bugs. Maybe not always big, but often big.
This year, they're about the size of German Shepherds.
That's big. But for her, it's an opportunity not only to have fun, but also to slip in a little actual education, working on people's knowledge on insects, because I think, as she has said many times, Hollywood hasn't always been real faithful to the hard scientific facts about insects. And so she's on a mission, has been for many years, to fix that. So we're going to do that. We'll talk about the festival, and insect questions are certainly welcome. Now, we're going to bug you about one other thing, and that is nice. Supporting the station. Okay, here's the deal. It's public broadcasting. There's no commercials. Most of the time when I do the show, I just have a great time talking with people on all kinds of things. And you call in and you ask questions, and it's only about that topic. No commercials. One of the great things for me doing this show is that I don't have to stop every couple of minutes when we're in the middle of some really intense, wonderful conversation and say, no, sorry, hold it right there. We got to come back to this. I have to stop. No, we don't do that. The reason we can do it like that is that listeners support the station with their dollars. That's the deal. That's why public broadcasting works, because the audience actually helps to pay for the programs. People have been doing that now. We have folks who are very, very loyal and have been supporting us for many, many years, and we cannot thank them enough. But thanks anyway. And so what we want to do, though, is to reach out to those folks who are listeners, but they're not supporters. Today is the day for you to change that. Call us. Go online. Change that now. Be a supporter of the station. Help keep the station strong and make it possible for us to keep doing this. Because you'd miss us, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
If you turned it on the radio and we weren't there, you'd miss us, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
All right. Molly Delaney, I'm really happy to have you here.
I'm very happy to be here. Never a dull moment on Focus. Mae actually brought some things with her. She brought her own kind of pledge kit here. So David was just saying, if you've never pledged before, today is the day. And I will tell you why. Mae brought two things that we're going to give away to the first two callers who make a pledge of over $40. And one of them is the Earwig's Tail, a modern bestiary of multi-legged legends. And within it, just for Valentine's Day, is the story about the kissing bug. So that's one of your choices. If you call in with that pledge of $40 or more, we're going to put those two callers into a drawing, essentially, and someone will get the Earwig's Tail. The other person will get Honey, I'm Homemade. And it is sweet treats from the beehive across the centuries and around the world. And it comes with a gift from the University of Illinois Bee Research Facility. So fabulous gifts for Valentine's Day. If you have not made a pledge of support to the station before, now's the time to do it. If you still need a gift for your honey, give us a call. We'll be happy to help you out. So again, first two callers with a pledge of $40 or more. And thanks to Mae for bringing that in and for making our Valentine's Day extra special. So 217-244-9455.
So you make honey. You're at your apiary, is that what you call it?
Yeah, University of Illinois actually
has an apiary?
Its own bees. Yes, U of I bees.
Really? So how much honey does that produce?
Well, it's interestingly, Gene Robinson heads the bee research facility, and for him, the honey is actually kind of a waste product of research. So he's not in the honey business. Mm. We don't actually sell honey. So this is very special, because we don't actually sell it. If you want honey made by U of I bees, if you're a Illini fan, this is your chance to have University of Illinois honey. And It's not for sale, but it's produced by the bees because they can't help themselves. That's what they do.
Right. Just like us with pledging, we can't help ourselves. Well, it's so nice to have you here, and this is one of the times about this time of year we'd like to have you on to talk about the festival, and about now it has been going on now for 29 years,
and
amazingly enough, but it started out with this kind of crazy idea you had that led to your family, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
I don't know if people have heard that story. That's how you and Richard, your husband, who was the film critic for the News Gazette and teaches in cinema studies, who was a movie guy, and you called him one day and said you were thinking about doing this, and he actually took the whole thing seriously.
Well, I didn't know. I had this idea to have a film festival, and I actually pitched it in graduate school at Cornell, and the head of the department there thought it was undignified. So I came here and worked a few years to establish my credentials as a legitimate scientist, and then asked my department head here, who thought it was a terrific idea, but then I didn't know how to put on a film festival. So I contacted the director of the unit for cinema studies, asking if the unit would like to co-sponsor. And, of course, the director gave it to the assistant director, who sent me a very nicely worded note saying that they were very busy that semester with French and German retrospectives, which was his nice way of saying we don't do kitsch. But he said he would help me and figure out how to do this. And here it is. Let's see. 6 years after that, we got married. So, and we're still, people often ask, don't you run out of films? No, there is a limitless supply of bad insect-related insect fear films coming out of Hollywood. No shortage at all.
More in when they're looking for something scary, more likely that that be an insect than anything else?
Well, part of it is when the insect is the adversary, you don't have to do much script writing because people come into the audience with this preconceived notion that the insect is the enemy. You don't have to think about how to design an alien creature because insects look about as different from humans as any organism that still shares the planet with us. So, you know, you don't have to use any imagination whatsoever. You just kind of take an insect and blow it up to a larger size or increase the numbers until they darken the sky or, you know, so just sort of exaggerate what and play on people's predisposed or predetermined preconceptions. So we're here we're preconception busters.
Yeah, yeah. And this year, every year the festival has a particular theme where you concentrate generally on a particular insect.
Mm-hmm.
It is ants? It is international ants?
Yeah, we actually did an ant festival years ago. It was our best attended festival, and it was a real aberration because we showed two films that had been nominated for an Academy Award. We typically never show films nominated for anything. One was called Angels and Insects, which was nominated for Best Costumes but didn't win. Mm-hmm. And I must say that was another aberration in that it was the one and only film in the 29-year history of the festival that featured full frontal male nudity. We were not going to do that again. And
It was based on the Margaret Atwood novel.
Mm-hmm. Novella.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting choice.
Yeah. And then the other one that year was, we rarely show films twice, but our first festival in 1984, we showed Them. And then for the Ant Festival, we had to show Them because it's the archetypal insect fear film, 1954, giant ants in the Arizona desert, the radiation-induced ants.
Hmm.
But we're showing two features we've never shown before from 2003 and 2005. It's they're an interesting new twist on the same familiar theme. And what's different this year, too, is when we had our last ant festival, we did not have an ant expert on our faculty, and we now do. So Dr. Andy Suarez is an internationally renowned ant expert, and we're going to have some pretty spectacular ants. We always like to have live specimens at the festivals, sort of meet the stars. You can actually, you know, see what a real ant looks like. And we have the world's second largest ant. It's not as big as a German shepherd. But
okay,
it's,
well, how big is the world's largest ant?
Well, this is Deinoponera australis. This is the second largest.
Second, okay.
It depends whether you go by length or mass. But it's almost 2 inches. It's a really big ant. There's some fossil ants that are bigger, but they're, these ants, you can actually see, they are amazingly big ants. And when we had them at the festival before, Andy set them up with a little in a setting with a little barn and a little cows, and it's really looked just like
an ant farm.
Yeah, an ant farm. Yes, mm-hmm. brought to life mm-hmm. in a scary fashion. And we're going to have another terrific ant experience for you, for listeners, would be to see our trap jaw ants. Andy works on trap jaw ants. These are ants that have enormously elongated mandibles, and they actually use them not only to catch prey but to locomote. They snap them, they open them up and then snap them shut with the fastest muscular contraction in any or animal appendage that's known. I think that record still holds. They actually slam. It's like, I should get the miles per hour. It's truly remarkable. Here it is. It's between 78 and 143 miles per hour. And it's amazing. These things snap shut, and it's amazing they don't fracture the jaws. And they use them not only to catch prey but to get away, because they'll snap them shut with such force that they end up somersaulting over. And it, this, as you might guess, kind of throws predators for a loop, because they don't really expect ants to end up flying through the air, because most ants, once they start the business of making a colony, don't have wings anymore. But these guys go shooting up in the air doing somersaults. And then they land. It's kind of amazing. They don't get dizzy and disoriented. They're really amazing. We actually have trap jaw ants that you can see here.
And living specimens of
living
both
specimens.
Of these guys?
They will be jumping.
Okay. They will be doing somersaults.
Yeah.
All right. And so,
not on command.
So you have the opportunity to see some movies, see a couple of movies, and also there will be the petting zoo, that's kind of what they call it, and an opportunity to ask questions and see some insects up close. So it's a great thing for it. Now, are the films family friendly?
We start out, this is International Ant Festival, okay. because, to differentiate it from our last ant festival, but also to emphasize the fact that ants basically rule. It's their planet. They make up, in some areas, about 25% of all biomass. They outweigh us, all the ants together. There's about 12,000 described species. So there are more species in this one family of insects. All ants belong to the same family. There are more species of ants than there are birds in the world, than there are mammals in the world. There are more ants, and we don't even know half of them. I mean, it's estimated that there's still another 12,000 to go. And they're on every continent except Antarctica. We actually covered Antarctica in our fossil insect fear film, our fossil arthropod fear film festival a couple of years ago. Somebody actually made a movie about trilobites in Antarctica. A very strange film. That's the past. So because they are all over the world in every kind of environment, I mean, ants are incredibly adaptable. So we're going to have a kind of a around-the-world tour of ants in animated films and shorts and commercials, starting with a 1911, one of the very first animated film, animated films.
I'm still thinking about ants in the shorts. I'm sorry, I haven't
ants
even gotten
in their
past
pants.
Ants.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that we actually showed ants in the pants, which is a Three Stooges short, but we showed that at our last festival. We won't show it this time. But the 1911 film is by Vladislav Starevich, who essentially invented stop motion animation, and did a version of The Grasshopper and the Ant, the famous Aesop fable. Mm-hmm. So we'll show that, and head back to Russia for 1983, a lovely short called Travels of an Ant, very nice animated cartoon animation film. We have a couple of French films, a French commercial. We have Ferdi di Amaisa, a whole animated cartoon series about Ferdi the Ant in German. It's been dubbed into all kinds of other languages. You can follow some of Ferdy's examples. We have some ant Budweiser commercials from China. There's a whole ad campaign focused on ants, Budweiser beer.
To sell beer?
Oh, yeah.
Using ants to sell beer.
Yeah. The ants in the American commercial basically collectively work to carry the bottle of beer down into their ant nest. Mm-hmm. In the Chinese one, I don't know, spoiler alert, they actually work together to flip the lid off the... Sorry about that. And then we have an Indian short, and then an ant extermination company short from Australia. So we have the first half hour is very kid friendly, very family friendly. And then we head to our movies, which are progressively, as the evening goes on, less family friendly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the first one, I don't know, should we go to the phones or should we answer or should I just talk about the festival?
Well, I'd say maybe it would be good
to see the lights flashing, the phones
because we don't, you know, not to make these folks wait too much longer. But actually, I will because I do want to get in here one more time to mention. Yeah, as if that'll be the last time. One more time to mention supporting the station. And I don't really know. Do we know now? Did we get some people in to get our wonderful prizes? We don't know. Okay. So, well, in
there's
any case,
there's still that
chance. There's still that chance. Well, we said we had a copy of May's book, The Earwig's Tale, and then the Honey Cookbook that they produced, Honey, I'm Homemade, and some actual University of Illinois, not available in any store, honey. So we said if two people would call in and make a pledge of $40 or more, somebody is going to win, you know, one of those two will win one of these.
And if you haven't bought Valentine's gifts yet, this is your chance.
So. And so, but we don't really know the status of this now. So I don't know if we should be making promises that we should just, well, we should just say, look,
it's
call.
Still a chance.
Go online.
It's a
There's
chance.
Still a chance.
That's right.
You know, that's right.
And I just, partly the reason I did this is to thank the listeners because, again, there are not that many stations across the country that would devote even 2 minutes to insects, much less put up with me year after year going on and on about insect.
Well, and I also must say, as my wife continues to remind me every time you're on the show, having you on the show was her idea. And this was, do you remember when the first time? 1982?
Yeah.
The first time you were on the show. It was a very long time ago.
Yeah.
And every time she goes, you know, that was my idea. And I say, yes, yes, that was your idea. And it worked out pretty well.
I think so.
So we're very glad.
To be here.
So let's give the number and the website just to, in case anybody is now thinking about making a contribution. Let's do it.
Okay, so we need you to respond by calling 217-244-9455 or by going to willpledge.org and making your contribution. Let me just say, two local treasures here in the studio today, May Barenbaum and David Inge. It doesn't get better than this, people. If you're not pledging today, I don't know what's wrong with you. So, again, urging you to get to your phone and make that pledge of support.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, let's talk with some folks here. Belgium. We'll go over to Belgium. Line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both.
Hey.
Ms. Barenbaum, I have an idea for a film that you would star in.
You would
be the main person. Last Thanksgiving, my wife and I went to spend Thanksgiving in Taipei.
Oh, my goodness.
It was great. It's an interesting place, Taiwan. And we both enjoy going to national parks. And down along the east coast of Taiwan, there's a national park called Furoko. This national park is amazing. It's a river that cuts through marble mountains. And it's just amazing sights. And it's set almost in the tropics. To walk into one of the trails, we walk up to a trailhead. And as any national park here has, they have signs warning you about what's going on, and they say, beware of poisonous wasps and spiders. And I thought it was snakes, not spiders, snakes, poisonous wasps and snakes. And I thought it was interesting that they would mention the wasp first. But it seems as though in Eastern Asia, there's a thing called the Asian giant hornet.
Yep.
They're big boys.
Yes, they are.
They're like hummingbirds. And a couple inches long, 3-inch wingspan, and where you would come into the topic is one of their major meals is bees.
Yep.
They like to eat bees. Now, the European bee especially, because the European bee doesn't know how to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
The Asiatic bee swarms, then increases the heat, and that kills the hornet before it gets to go back and tell its buddies to come and kill the rest of the hive. And I thought that would be just, you know, it's just so amazing of an animal that it would be a film. So I looked online a little bit about it, and it seems as though there's a certain amount of controversy, and this is where your knowledge is much more than mine. It seems along on the East Coast from, like, Virginia down to Georgia, North Carolina, people keep saying that they see these things.
No, they're seeing a different, it's a yellow jacket they're seeing, not the giant Asian hornet.
I thought maybe they might be seeing cicada killers, but there's... Mm. Another yellow jacket that's...
Yeah, there's a German yellow jacket that's an invasive species. It's also pretty fearsome, but not the giant Asian hornet. I think it's Vespula mandarina. I'm not sure about the genus name, Vespa or Vespula. And it is the scourge of honeybees. And you're absolutely right. The the Western honeybee does not know how to cope with it, and they can go in and they'll just destroy a hive.
The interesting thing about these things, though, is that they go into the hive, they snap the heads off of these bees, they carry the bee back to their larvae, feed the bee to the larvae, and then the larvae exudes the food that the adult hornet eats, which seems very odd and scary in a way.
Oh, well, I mean, there are all kinds of child exploitation examples among the insects, including, for example, the weaver ants, which live in these nests in trees. And the way they assemble these nests, they stitch the leaves together using silk, but they don't make the silk. They actually produce grubs, and they induce the grubs to spin silk. So they hold their grubs like a shuttle on a loom, and make the kids spit out the silk to stitch the leaves together. So child exploitation, I guess, is a fairly common theme in the insect world. But it's interesting you mentioned the giant hornet, because there's just a recent paper that came out like within the last month. Not only does the Asian honeybee know how to cook these guys to death, they can raise their body temperature. So they mass onto these hornets that get into their nests and collectively decouple their wings, raise their thoracic temperatures to just below their tolerance threshold, but it's just above the threshold of the hornets, and they die of heat prostration, basically. They also apparently make a warning sound. These bees will buzz a different way when a hornet is near. And the investigators tested, and they brought a butterfly near the beehive, and it didn't really do much to the bees. Didn't even consider it enough to remark upon. But the Asian hornet elicited a very special investigators called a warning cry, that we know you're there. We know you're out there. Kind of like a burglar alarm.
Is there any way that these large bees from Eastern Asia could survive in the United States or in Western Hemisphere?
You mean the giant hornets?
Yes.
Far be it for me to say an insect can't make it somewhere in the world. Hard to say, hard to imagine. Little things get into the U.S. much more easily than big things. If you can imagine smuggling, I mean, it would be our worst pests, and that actually brings up a Valentine's story, but that's another point. Our worst pests in terms of invasive species are the ones that are very small and get smuggled in, you know, and just aren't noticed. Right now, the biggest challenge, Valentine's Day is a huge challenge to Customs and Border Protection because of flowers. Flowers come in from all over the world. And Chicago actually is the sixth largest port for introducing flowers. And they inspect them because a lot of pests can come in. And I think they've found 50 to date already in Chicago. 3.2 million fresh cut flowers are imported into the U.S. every year. And most of them around between January and now. So it's a huge challenge. And what gets in are the thrips, the little tiny, tiny 2-millimeter long plant pests. So, you know, these giant Asian hornets are in excess of 2 inches. It would be really hard to smuggle one in.
I was just wondering if somebody did something evil.
Oh, they could. One of the festivals. Yeah, that would be an interesting. Although there is Turnabout is Fair Play. These wasps are used to produce an energy drink in Asia called VAA, Vespa Amino Acids. It's supposed to be, you know, like our 5-hour energy sort of thing.
Really?
Only it's wasp amino acids. I don't know if it works or not.
Thank you very much.
Right, sure. Thank you. Let's go over to Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. And in keeping with the thing about honeybees, I have some friends who are very bee conscious, shall we say. And they told me one time, a few days ago, what do you want? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, talking about the disappearance of the bees, mm-hmm. and things came up, and I started thinking this is the beginning of an urban legend, and you showed up on the radio, so I thought I'd throw it to you and see if you know anything about it, that they discovered that there's a form of talc that's used in seeds that farmers plant in their fields because it slips quickly and stops buildup of seeds in the pipe that goes down into the ground to leave the seed behind, and that the talc is such a size it gets into the pores of the bees and it cannot breathe. Do you know anything about that?
I've actually seen references to those stories, this powdery talc-like substance. Most likely works not so much by asphyxiating the bees, but often sort of chalk-like substances have the effect of disrupting the wax layer on the external, the exoskeleton of the insect. All insects have, well, almost all insects, can't generalize,
so they just
have
a wax layer. Sidestep on what's actually the cause, because I wanted to step in and start, saying very silly things. I'm glad I couldn't say them because I turned out more ignorant than they were.
Oh, no. There's some question as to how much of a factor that is. There's also concern that seeds go into the ground treated with a group of pesticides called neonicotinoids. And because the seeds are treated, these insecticides become systemic. That is, they occur in the sap of the plants, and then when the plants flower, they occur in nectar and pollen. And there's a lot of concern about whether these neonicotinoids, which are neurotoxins, they disrupt the nervous system, actually influence bees. And every seed practically in central Illinois, be it corn or soybean, is pre-treated with these insecticides. So they're all kind. People are speculating about all kinds of possible contributing factors.
Yeah.
It's tough to be a bee these days.
Yeah, I'll ask you in a quickie. Has anyone ever done a film, either for science research, which would follow certain insects or even any worm, as far as that goes, or slugs or whatever, into the soil, go down with them in their tunnels and see the interactions and things like that that go on? I was wondering if that had been done.
There might be some scenes. There's a very famous French documentary called Microcosmos, which has phenomenal photography, and it's all sort of focused in a French meadow. And there are some scenes. You mentioned snails or slugs. There's apparently a very romantic scene of courtship between two hermaphroditic snails. I mean, each one had both sets of reproductive parts. You have to see it. I mean, hard to describe. But that's very famous for its macro photography, and there very well might be scenes of subsoil activities. There's a very famous entomologist named Walter Chinkle who lives in Florida, and he's sort of well known for digging down to see how far down ant colonies go. And he's developed a method of pouring material in so that the colony, the structure, gets sort of preserved in this resinous material. And then he chips away at all the surrounding soil. So you can actually see how incredibly complex these structures are. And some ants, fire ants, you may despise them for their above-ground activity, but underground they construct the most magnificent structures.
We have opportunity to ask some more questions here. I want to thank the callers and say that our guest this morning in this hour is May Barenbaum, and she is the head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. We're talking about insects. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have different topics every week. Just a quick mention that tomorrow we'll do two programs, and actually all together this week we're doing four programs that have to do with water, to get people thinking about when you turn on the tap at your house, where does that water come from? And then once it goes down the drain, where does it go? In the first hour, we'll talk with Martin Melosi. He is an historian at University of Houston, and we'll try to talk a little bit about where water comes from, and he's author of Precious Commodity, Providing Water for America's Cities. And then we'll really bring it here to the local level, talking a little bit about how here our water and sewage systems work. That'll be in the second hour tomorrow, and we'll have as our guests Dennis Schmidt, who's Director of Public Works for Champaign, and Ron Smith, who's a Senior Operations Manager at the American Illinois Water Corporation. So, again, a little bit, try to raise people's consciousness about water. You know, it has to come from somewhere, and it has to go somewhere. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And we're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. You can look at our website to get the schedule. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. And in this hour focus, we're very happy to have May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. Occasionally, she's here on the program and talks about insects. And about this time of year, we also talk about the Fear Film Festival, Insect Fear Film Festival, that will be, and I think all the talking we did about it, we didn't say when it was. It's the 25th, right? On Saturday the 25th?
Yeah, in Folinger on campus, Folinger Auditorium. Doors open at 6 for displays and exhibits, and we'll have the artwork that has been entered into the art competition from all the local schools on display. We have some spectacular photographs from our local departmental affiliate, Alex Wild. He's a prize-winning photographer, and he has a soft spot for ants, and they're just amazing images. We also, well, again, like, as you mentioned, we'll have insect petting zoo, face painting, and an array of activities. At 7 o'clock, we'll have announced the winners of the art competition. We'll have some commentary about the films. And then at 7:30, we'll sew the shorts. And at 8 o'clock, we'll start with our first feature. So should I talk about the features?
Let me do one other thing here. Let me remind people who are listening that we're raising money to support the station, and it's the last day of our mini drive. So if you were thinking about making a pledge or going online, now would be a good time to do it. And you can come away with that good feeling that knows not only are coming. Let me try that over again. You will come away with that good feeling that comes from the fact that you know you are more than just a listener. You're also a supporter. It didn't have to be that hard, but you know, sometimes I just like to make things really hard. 244-9455, willpledge.org. And here in the studio with me this morning is Molly Delaney, and I'm real happy that she's here.
And you can come away with more than just a good feeling, because we have yet to give away these two books that May brought with her, one being The Earwig's Tale, which is her book, which the subtitle says, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legends. And she brought it today because it has a story of the kissing bug. It is totally appropriate for Valentine's Day. You know, beat me to the punch, because I have to tell you, if that's not gone soon, I'm going to take it home. And then we have Honey, I'm Homemade, which has sweet treats from the beehive from across the centuries and around the world, also from May. And then a gift from the University of Illinois Research Facility, Honey, that you cannot get anywhere else, just like you cannot get Focus anywhere but WILL. So again, the first two pledges of $40 or more, you get put into a drawing for one of these two books. And I'm telling you, if they're not gone, I'm taking them. So we need to hear from you. We need to hear from you now at 244-9455.
Okay. Am I remembering right? Is you one of your grandmother's recipes in the book?
Several of my family recipes, but most, there's a big hunk of recipes from my husband's older cousin, Herm, who spent, I'd say, 90 of her 95 years collecting recipes. So these recipes go from all the way back. We have the recipes from the Illinois State Fair culinary honey competitions going back to the early part of the 20th century. We have recipes from our graduate students and postdocs who come from all over the world. So, there are recipes from the Catalan region of Spain. There's recipes from Korea. There's recipes from Hungary. It's an interesting collection.
Yeah. So it's all of so that's the deal. The book is all about cooking with honey.
Sweets, desserts. Yeah. So there are no like barbecue marinades in there. Maybe the next one.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of okay. Sweet treats, not just. Okay. Yeah, that's because I'm a vegetarian. How on earth would I know what a good pork marinade is? I'm a Jewish vegetarian.
You could put it on tofu, probably. Grilled tofu?
Yeah. Well, maybe volume two.
Okay. So anyway, the important thing is that if you've been listening to us natter on here over the last few days and we're breaking you down, now is the time to make the pledge. Call. Go online.
That's right. Last day, 244-9455.
Okay. All right. Please don't make me take these books back with me.
No. Molly's going to take them.
I'm telling you. I actually have a child who would be extremely happy with the Earwig's Tale.
Yes. Okay. So we do want to mention, we want to talk about the feature films that you're going to be showing.
Mm-hmm. Our first film is called Glass Trap. This is a movie, a little hard to figure out exactly what the plot is, but it involves some waste plutonium from an Iraqi terrorist cell that somehow was transported with some plants in the roots of which were ants. So when they were delivered to the nursery in California, the ants somehow escaped notice, despite the fact they'd grown to be the size of German shepherds. So about 3 feet or so. And they, the plants are delivered, again, by a florist who doesn't seem, or a greenhouse manager doesn't seem to notice the giant ants, to an office building in Los Angeles, where, which is almost vacant over the weekend, but they do manage to find the one floor where there's people, including Stella Stevens, and run amok. And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of, it's not really scary. No, not really. And there's some great, dialogue in there. It's directed by Fred Olen Ray, who is perhaps best known for Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers. What else? Bad Girls from Mars. What else? Bikini A-Go-Go.
So really top level stuff.
Yeah, this is this lives up to his reputation. And it features C. Thomas Howell in the lead. He, again, had a promising career as a child teen actor, and kind of peaked early. And now he's in films like Glass Trap. Mm-hmm. Our second film is very strange. It's from South Africa, and it's called
The Bone Snatcher.
Bone Snatcher, and that is it's a movie about diamond miners crossing the Namib Desert, filmed on location, who suddenly mysteriously start disappearing, and all that remains are skeletons. And it turns out these ants are swarming in the desert. They're regular ant size, but they mass together to form, spoiler alert, to form human-like shapes to attack and kill vertebrates to steal their bones so that they can have an endoskeleton. Now, I love this concept of endoskeleton envy. I mean, one of the distinctive features that separate insects from mammals, we have our skeletons on the inside, insects have them on the outside. Actually works pretty well if you're very small to have an external skeleton, but not according to the script writers here.
They're jealous of us because we have our skeletons
on the
inside?
Well, they are killing these things to take their bones so that they can have an armature for their massed treks across the desert. Doesn't make a lot of sense. You have to wait 42 minutes before you even see an ant in this movie. But then it gets fairly grisly. So that's our second feature. And we've never shown a movie from South Africa before. So it actually opened in Bahrain. I don't know why. And nobody that I recognize, nobody who's famous in here, but it's just an interesting concept, and it fits the theme of international ants.
All right. This is the internationally famous Insect Field Film Festival for 2012, and this will be taking place on the 25th of February, this is Saturday, in the Follinger Auditorium on campus. It's free, and as May said, sort of the earlier parts are really more family-friendly, so you can bring the kids, and then they'll have to go away when we get around to the bone snatcher. That probably is not appropriate for young viewers. And unless you'd really, of course, you could introduce them to the films of Stella Stevens, maybe, but I don't know if that would be appropriate for children either. Well, you said that really it's not terribly scary?
No, it's so over the top that it would be. I mean, there's like gratuitous models on the roof of a building doing a lingerie shoot, you know, just so that the ants can, you know, pull at their lingerie. It's just really kind of not scary.
Okay. Right. Well, we have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. Champagne? Let's talk with somebody in Champagne. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
There's been a lot of research in all life dealing with DNA sequencing and so forth. Have there been some sequences done on insect life that could illuminate a lot of the behaviors and also the kinds of, you were just talking about outside skeletons versus inside skeletons and so forth. Have we learned some things from DNA sequencing of insects that is very interesting and exciting?
Actually, U of I is kind of a center for insect genome sequencing. Thanks for asking that question. My colleague Gene Robinson, who heads up the bee research facility, headed up the International Honeybee Genome Sequencing Project. So honeybee genome was sequenced in 2006 and has yielded all kinds of interesting insights into social behavior. Ooh. Turns out that humans and insects on average share almost 50% of the genes. You wouldn't think we would, but there are many, many genes in insects that have what are called orthologs, or exact counterparts in humans. So the nice thing about that is you can do experiments with insects you can't possibly even contemplate doing on insect on humans. So we can actually do manipulations, do what's called knocking out RNAi technology. We can knock out the genes genetically using molecular techniques, and then see what happens to the insect when that gene is removed. And it sheds light on what it would do to us people. Another project that was partially based in the University of Illinois is the Body Louse Genome Project. Pediculus humanus was sequenced here in part on our campus. And that, of course, sheds a lot of light on humans because, frankly, this is an insect whose entire life revolves around its association with humans, has no other food source. It spends every day of its life on a human. It eats nothing but human blood. So this is one of our very closest associates. We have been involved in the sequencing of parasitic wasp genomes. I'm involved in a Lepidopteran sequencing project. That's a moth, actually. The navel orange worm, which is a big pest in California. And there's all kinds of insect genome sequencing. In fact, our campus is home to what's called the I5K. It's an insect sequencing, they call it Manhattan Project for Insects. The challenge is to sequence 5,000 insect genomes in the next 5 years. And 5,000 sounds like a lot, but it's only a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the 900,000 plus species of insects that we know of. But 5,000 will hit most of the medical pests, most of the agricultural pests, most of the model species, and then some of the species that are interesting because of their evolutionary relationships with other organisms. And we're involved. People are kind of volunteering to get involved and, you know, sort of pick a genome and sequence it kind of thing. Enormous amounts of information can be gained by this so-called comparative genomics approach, seeing what's different, seeing what's conserved, what's saved across insect genomes. I'm personally involved in figuring out how honeybees get along with so few genes for detoxifying poisons. They have only about a third to a half of what other insects have. And what it's looking like is honeybees are like us. We have about 100 genes in one particular family that break down toxins, but half of them don't work. They've kind of mutated, so they're useless. And one of the thoughts behind this is that we humans have used behavior and our intelligence. Instead of dying from poisons, we talk to each other, don't eat that, you'll get sick. And we cook. We use behavior to detoxify things. Turns out honeybees do the same thing. They process their food. And some of the steps of converting nectar into honey, which you can learn all about in the book Honey, I'm Homemade, actually reduce the toxin content. So unlike any other insect, any other organism, honeybees may use behavior like we do to deal with toxins, poisons in their food.
Oh, wow. And can you determine that relationship in terms of the genes?
Well, I mean, what sort of tipped us off was how few they had, and the parallel is how many we have that have lost their functions. So in other cases, you can find exact genes that there's one that controls eye development, in fact, in humans, and it controls eye development even in insects, even though insect eyes look totally different. You know, there are those compound jobs with 18,000 to 30,000 different facets, but it turns out that developmentally they're not that different after all.
Wow, thank you so much. And
thank you.
The work that you're doing is really exciting.
Well, thanks for the call. And isn't it, I know, actually, I think I talked a little bit about this with Gene, that one of the interesting things that he found out was that there seems that in bees that there may indeed be behaviors that are genetically encoded.
Oh, absolutely. And similar to ours, he received some measure of fame and a shout out from the Colbert Report for work he did with a postdoc here named Andy Barron on bees and cocaine. Interesting. He was investigating addiction behavior. We don't have very many model systems for addiction, and it turns out that bees kind of get a feeling of well-being or reward because the cocaine acts on the same brain center that it acts on in humans. So bees on cocaine dance more vigorously than bees that are not on cocaine. So, and bees get addicted to alcohol, too, and nicotine. So there's a lot of things that we can learn from
bees. Amazing, absolutely amazing. We'll try to do one more caller at least. Champaign County, I believe that would be line number two. Hello?
Hi. I thought since it's Valentine's Day, maybe you could elaborate about honey. It's such a storied thing, and it's said to be an aphrodisiac because of the prostaglandins, maybe. I don't know. I'm thinking of the song "She's as Sweet as Tupelo Honey," and it reminds me that tupelo flowers have something like 70% lobulose, as opposed to
exactly.
Tupelo. Maybe you can riff on that a little bit.
Okay. Tupelo honey is one of the most highly prized honeys. In fact, it's one of the few varietal honeys that's officially recognized by the USDA. You can only make it in one region of Florida and Georgia, a swampy region where the tupelo gum trees grow. And you have to bring your bees to this region. They can't visit any other flowers. And you're right, levulose or fructose. The nice thing about tupelo honey, with its high level of this sugar called fructose. There's fructose and glucose, or simple sugars. They combine to form sucrose, which is table sugars. Honeybees make honey basically by busting up sucrose into fructose and glucose. But the nectar of the tupelo tree actually is mostly fructose in the nectar. Fructose means that honey from tupelo's sources never crystallizes. You know how you leave your honey on the shelf and it turns solid. Nothing's wrong with it. It just the crystals have settled out of solution. Honey is a super saturated sugar solution, which is why, by the way, germs won't grow in honey. Yeast won't grow in honey because there's not enough water to support the growth of bacteria or yeast. So never lick your spoon and put it back in the honey jar, because not only is it disgusting, but it introduces enough water to break that super saturated solution and invite the growth of microbes like yeasts, which is, by the way, how mead was invented. Which you can read all about in Honey, I'm Homemade.
I just think that tupelo is just the most wonderful, magical, special, fabulous thing that I think I ever had in my life, tupelo honey.
It is really a remarkable stuff.
Yes.
There's a whole movie, actually. Well, not the whole movie. Ulysse Gold with Peter Fonda. He is a beekeeper, and he specializes in tupelo honey. You can actually see how it's made. He collaborated with the family, the Laney family in Florida, that's famous for their tupelo honey.
Yeah, it's a very nice movie, too.
It is.
It's a very, very nice movie.
I mean, the human stuff is kind of distracting, but the
but the bee stuff is really good.
Really cool.
Yeah, I know. We're getting down to the point here where we almost have to go.
And I
don't think we can get one more call. Well,
Okay.
But maybe you will come back again sometime in the next couple of months, maybe when it gets a little bit warmer.
I'm so grateful to WILL AM 580, Focus 580, for putting insects on the air. I mean, they're already in the air, but WILL
they're probably on all
on
of us, too. So if you really look close, that's the thing. They're pretty close to us, and May has written. And if you go down to the library, go to the bookstore, look for some of the things that she's written. If you're interested in reading about insects, you could find The Earwig's Tale, I'm sure, and some of the – what's the book that's the collection of essays? Is it Bugs in the – I'm thinking of Bugs
Buzzwords?
In the System? Oh, maybe it's Buzzwords.
Bugs in the System is the sort of textbooky thing.
Okay, and it's about insects and their role in human affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
May Barenbaum, she's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois.